I'm Scott, 87MI, and this is Radio Safari. On today's show, ham radio in Korea. And, back by popular demand, another radio show from the Golden Age. But first...
Before we return, let's hear the story of how one man developed a taste for family parties and Schlitz beer.
Well, ordinarily, I look forward to family parties like I look forward to 2 weeks of rain on my vacation. Oh, but I make one exception. There's a certain relative of my wife who can win me away from my fireside any day. He's the one who introduced me to Schlitz beer, and I still thank him for it. I remember when this relative first invited us over for a family get-together. My wife wanted to go, and I didn't, so we compromised and went. On the way over, I visualized a dismal evening playing some game like charades, which I happened to particularly detest. But things began to look up the moment our host greeted us at the door and said, I hope you won't mind if we don't waste the evening playing silly parlor games. And when I discovered that we were both fly fishermen, well, I began to think of my host as more of a friend than a relative. It was just about then that he brought in the Schlitz beer. Well, the evening was full of pleasant surprises. I'd heard many good things about Schlitz and had always planned to try it. So try it I did. And never have I tasted a beer as satisfying. As I drank, I found myself hoping that this particular in-law would throw another family party very soon. And I found myself saying, as surely others have said in tasting this fine beer, no wonder they call Schlitz a beer that made Milwaukee famous.
You're listening to Voice of Korea. Here's the news. The Chinese Xinhua News Agency on the 23rd reported the news of the great leader Kim Jong-il's field guidance to the Pyongyang Medical College of Kim Il-sung University and the soy sauce workshop newly built at the Ryongsung Foodstuff Factory. The news agency said he was accompanied by Kim Jong-un, vice chairman of the Central Military Commission of the Workers' Party of Korea. The Inter Tass of Russia also reported the same news. The Peruvian Association for the Study of the Revolutionary Activities of Kim Jong-suk recently issued a bulletin on the occasion of the 19th anniversary of the appointment of the great leader Kim Jong-un.
Okay, now to talk a little bit about amateur radio here in Korea. First, we'll talk about licensing. The easiest way to get a license to operate here in Korea is through KARL, or the Korean Amateur Radio League. KARL was founded in 1955, and it works to promote amateur radio communications, and it's a member of the International Amateur Radio Union. Much like ARRL, KARL is the South Korea version. Wikipedia has an entry for KARL, and it talks about HL2 Alpha Alpha, which was the first amateur radio station in South Korea. That's what it says, and that's true from the standpoint of it being the first amateur radio station that received a license from the Republic of Korea. But U.S. servicemen have operated amateur radio in Korea just after World War II, and to include an important operation that took place during the opening days of the Korean War. There's a very interesting QST article that was published in the early 1950s that talks about how an officer on MacArthur's staff maintained contact with U.S. forces here in Korea during the opening hours of the Korean War, when all the standard communications had been severed. It's also interesting to note that initially after World War II, stations in Korea had the same J or Juliet prefix as Japan. And then for those who need a quick history refresher, Japan had long occupied Korea until that was brought to an end by Japan's defeat in World War II. And shortly after Japan's surrender, Korea was partitioned. Russia was had the north, and the U.S. had the south. That partition eventually helped contribute to the outbreak of war in 1950. Back to amateur radio. As a foreigner, to obtain a license to operate in Korea, KARL has a form you can fill out, and it requires a fee that's payable in won, the currency here in the Republic of Korea. It's about $85 U.S., and you also, of course, need a copy of your FCC amateur radio license. The license is good for 1 year, and at which time you can renew it. However, the calls that's issued is it's Hotel Lima, or HL, and then a number for the area in the country that you're operating in, and then your stateside call. So when I first went through this process, I had HL2 stroke AD7MI. Now, if you're a member of the U.S. military or part of the United Nations Command here in Korea, it's possible to obtain a license through USFK or U.S. Forces Korea. You need to contact the 1st Signal Brigade located in Seoul, and they'll provide the forms you need to receive a South Korean call sign, and the prefix on that is Hotel Lima 9. It's a Hotel Lima 9 call sign, and those are only issued directly by the U.S. military. And the great thing about those licenses is that it's no cost, so they're free. The hardest part, though, is finding who to submit your application to. There is help. There's a local group here. You can find them on Yahoo called HL9 underscore amateurs, HL9 amateurs. It's a Yahoo group of expats who can help you navigate the process of getting the license to operate here in Korea. Also, they occasionally hold social gatherings. The majority of the folks live in and around Seoul. I'm about an hour north of Seoul, so it's a little harder for me to get down there for the activities, but it's a great group of folks. There's a IRLP node that's active in Seoul, node number 3510. It's operated by Steve Herman, 6 kilo 0 foxtrot kilo. It's kind of an interesting South Korean call. They have one segment of that's not HL9s that they have access to, so it's kind of a unique call sign. Steve Herman works for the Voice of America. Has spent a lot of time in Japan. I got a chance to meet him latter part of last year. Had a real great talk with him, and it was very interesting to hear about his previous activities with amateur radio. He's worked all around the world and has had the opportunity to operate amateur radio from a great many locations. Has some great stories. In terms of IRLP, I also maintain a node up here at my location at Camp Red Cloud. It's node number 3370. Due to my QTH challenges, the range of the that node's limited, but chances are during the weekend, you can often raise me on the node when I'm not already monitoring the Western Reflector 9100. Now, I just mentioned about QTH challenges. There are quite significant for my operation here. I live on the first floor of a three-story barracks, and there are a lot of power lines and communication lines that are strung all around the camp here, which limits my antenna options. What I've been using fairly successfully is a buddy pole antenna. And I set it up on most weekends, running the feed line through my window. The barracks blocks my signal to the west, so normally I leave the buddy pole configured as a horizontal dipole facing north-south. I've had good success working the U.S. West Coast and also into Europe. I really enjoy working stations in the Pacific, like some of the smaller islands. So despite the challenges of the QTH, I'm able to get on the air with the buddy pole and enjoy some QSOs. But when I first arrived here in Korea last June, none of the HL9 expat community could figure out exactly how to obtain a HL9 license. The subject matter expertise that had existed in the group had dissipated, and those who were in the know had returned back to the States. So rather than waiting and spending my time trying to research it, I applied for and received a regular license that foreigners get, and I was issued the call sign HL2 stroke AD7MI. And that was a really tough call sign to use and make, and made having QSOs a real challenge. In the late fall, a SURFS member who was working down in Seoul, he was able to crack the code on getting HL9 licenses through U.S. Forces Korea. And I was also able to apply for one, and I received it at the beginning of this year. That's made it a lot easier using my current call here in Korea, HL9MI, than using HL2 stroke AD7MI. Makes getting on the air with these fairly difficult conditions a little bit better. So that's kind of a brief overview of my operations here in Korea. I really enjoy getting on the air here, and it's a great way to occupy my time when I'm not at work, and during the weekends getting on. I've had a great many QSOs with Japan and Russia, China, Taiwan, nearby countries, but also have been able to work some really great DX. So really enjoyed it. I'd like to read an excerpt from a book that I read at the latter part of last year called A Year of DX by Bob Locher, W9KNI. It's a great book. Bob writes about how he spent a year and kind of details all the DX contacts he made during the period of 1 year from January to December pursuing CQ's awards for the number of DX contacts that can be made in a year. It's called the CQ Marathon, and he wrote about his experiences in pursuing that. But he's got a chapter here, chapter 15, and it's very original writing, and I wanted to share this with you. That's chapter 15, and again, this is from a Year of DX by Bob Locher, W9KNI. The book was published by Idiom Press, copyright 2010. This is chapter 15, titled Walter Mitty, DXer, and he starts off with apologies to James Thurber. I sat there, headphones glued on, listening. Papa 5-stroke Victor Romeo 2 X-ray Alpha had been reported last night on 20 meters CW, one I needed badly. The band is very quiet tonight, with few signals. I have the RF gain turned high, but then I almost always do. Now I am tuning right around the reported frequency. My attention begins to fade as I listen to the white noise, interrupted with occasional weak static crashes. My eyes glaze over, doubtless thanks to my early start this morning. I lay there under the camouflage netting, watching the Jeep trail winding round the hill below me. I am thirsty, but I ignore it. A fly buzzes around my face. I dare not move. I took my position hours before dawn to evade the constant sentinels everywhere. I watched the trees slightly below my hillside ledge, keeping a constant awareness of the wind. It is still moving from left to right, about a 2-click deflection on the scope as the range I plan my shot. Escape will be difficult. Hundreds of soldiers will be swarming after me, even if they are tired reservists pulled back from the front. If somehow in the confusion I can make it to the river, I'll have a chance. That's my plan. Now it is nearly the moment our informant gave us. Almost daily, the general would be passing by in his jeep, using the rough road winding below my position, across the gorge and above the river. I pray today will be the day, else I'll be doing this again tomorrow, and the next day, and however many it takes. Suddenly, I see the dust rising in the road, from around the turn before I can see what's coming. Moving very carefully, very slowly, I bring my hooded binoculars to bear. There. Yes, a Jeep coming slowly around the corner. I focus on the vehicle. I see two men, one driving, the other holding an automatic rifle, both in combat dress. But they are too young to be my man. Wait! A second Jeep comes into view. I swing my glasses. Almost instantly, I exult. There he is. A driver in the front, and the general sitting alone in the back, in civilian dress. No doubt about it. Yes! The men in the first jeep must be aides or bodyguards. I wonder for a moment why it would be in the second vehicle, eating dust from the first, but then I understand. They fear the road might be mined. The jeeps move slowly, probably to keep the dust down for the general. All the better for me. I carefully slide my rifle into position, slip off the safety, set my cheek onto the stock, and ease it onto my target. Yes, that's him for sure. Okay, let him come to another 100 yards closer. I start my breathing exercise, slowly, and steadying myself. This is sweet. With one shot, I'll break the back of the enemy forces. The free world will rejoice. I click out one notch elevation. My bullet will drop less in the thin air of the hot afternoon. The crosshairs slip down over his chest. I begin to slowly take the slack out of the trigger. Wait, what's that noise? Oh, a CQ. My eyes flutter open. I read the display. It's the right frequency. Could it be? Oh, rats. It's a JH1. Oh, he's maritime mobile. I realize I have not moved the dial for some minutes. I rouse myself and begin to tune again. I should be hearing at least a few JA signals and maybe some South Koreans. Maybe the band is not too hot tonight. I check the spotting info again. After all, the spot did come from a VK in Melbourne. He may have had propagation that we don't have at this hour. It does seem a little late for the path, but so what? I have to watch the trail. Oops, I mean frequency, of course. If I am to have any hope of nailing him. But maybe he won't use the same frequency. I shift my position in my chair. This is shaping up to be a long evening. The band begins to get a little noisier. Mainly it seems to be static crashes. I wonder if they are being propagated from far away or if they are ground wave. I ease back in my chair listening as my eyes droop again. Sir, I have a contact, bearing 310 degrees, a single screw, going fast. What course is he steering? I hold my hand up, asking for quiet, and listen even harder. I adjust the inductive transducer, then neutralize the internal amplifier drift. My trained ears are the boat's contact with the undersea world around us. Sir is coming right at us. Range? I'd say 6,000 yards, sir. Okay, up periscope. Headphones clamped to my ear. I turn my chair to watch the skipper at the attack periscope eyepiece. His hat turned backwards, his hands on the control bar as the scope rises in its housing. Suddenly, the skipper stiffens. He sees something. It can only be the ship I am hearing. He watches intently, then gives his order. It's an enemy destroyer coming right at us. Set tube 1 for 308 degrees, tube 2 for 312 degrees, then flood all forward tubes. Aye, sir. Tube 1 at 308 degrees, tube 2 at 312 degrees, flood all forward tubes. I yank off the headphones to avoid the sound of the rushing water flooding into the tubes, then put the phones back on when the tubes are full. All tubes flooded, sir. Open outer doors. Aye, sir. Open out doors. I hear the machinery uncapping the torpedo tube. The skipper stiffens, then pulls the periscope tube down. They see us. They're firing at us. Fire tubes 1 and 2, then take her down to 400 feet. Emergency dive. Turn hard port. When we reach depth, go silent. Aye, sir. I hear the pneumatic gasps as the torpedoes are rudely ejected from their tubes, and the climbing, high-pitched whine of their propellers as they come up to speed. As the klaxon horns begin the emergency dive signal for the crew, I hear several surface explosions close to us. It must be the shells fired at us striking the water. I shift my weight in my seat as the nose of our boat goes down. I hear the urgent, probing pinging coming from the enemy ship. I hear our torpedoes begin their run, small blades whining away at a high pitch. As the torpedo noise weakens, as they race away from us, more and more of my headphones are filled with the sound of a much larger propeller thrashing the water, coming closer, ever closer. My mind is sorting out all the different noises, trying to make sense of them. The pinging gets loud, very loud. I turn down the sensitivity of my set. I call out, Skipper, he's almost on us. Our torpedoes passed him, they missed. He is changing course. He picked up our turn. I keep listening. Then I hear the sound all submariners dread. I scream, depth charges, and yank my headphones off before the terrible explosions that I know are surely coming. Almost instantly, I hear a tremendous explosion, then another. I'm being rudely shaken. Bob, wake up. There's a big thunderstorm coming. Quick, unplug your antenna. I open my eyes, startled, and spring out of my chair, reach over to the shack master switch and shut down the station. I go to the coax connector at the wall and quickly undo the feed line and pull the cable back so it's far from the connector. I turn to my wife. Thanks, love. Thanks a lot. I was dreaming there. The next night, I'm back in the shack, headphones clamped on, turning the knob. I'm in trouble on this one, and I know it. The headline story is, DXer's tout sheet. Confirm this. PA 5-stroke Victor Romeo 2 X-ray Alpha to QRT soon. 120 QSOs so far. Ugh. Slim chance, but still a chance. I check the beam heading again, right on. The time too, right when he was reported. Frequency, right in the range of reported spots. My eyes are glued to the panel of the rig, and I turn the knob, probing, tuning. The band's very quiet. The only signal I hear is the Japanese beacon, but it's 569. So we have propagation, at least for a while. It's already the middle of the evening, late for the band, but I have no choice. I'm tired and short of sleep already, but I need the QSO, and now is when he's reported active. I could be doing this for hours, and I keep looking, tuning, listening, accompanied by the hum of the power supply transformer in the background. I'm in trouble, and I know it. I'm already 6 hours out of Papeete in my little Cessna 172, searching desperately for the tiny Tiki rover. I have 30 minutes of fuel left at best, good for about 60 more miles, and then I'm dead stick landing. I'm lost high over a trackless ocean. The knock on my door had come at midnight, just after I was going QRT. I'm Le Airport Director Emile D'Angenou. There is an emergency, a fatal sickness, on the island of Tiki Roa, 900 kilometers west of us. A serum must be flown there immediately. Lives are at stake. Why are you talking to me? You know I only have a small Cessna. I shall explain. The airstrip on Tiki Roa is only 400 meters long. It was 2,000 meters until the typhoon hit. Yours is the only plane in Tahiti that has the range required and can land on such a short strip. We know you have the range since you flew here from Hawaii. Would there be fuel on the island for my return flight? Regrettably, no. No plane has landed there for 2 years since the runway was damaged. But we will send fuel by the next ship, so you will be there for 6 weeks. The delicious Cynthia Savard, our famous French film star, has promised to pay all expenses. But how is she involved in this? I shall tell you. She owns a beautiful luxury retreat, a hideaway on the island, which she bought recently after winning the Cannes Golden Palm for Beaches of Nature. She is resident there now, and I regret to say that she is one of those in desperate need of the serum. And so I had taken off shortly after noon, loaded with fuel. The serum sat next to me, packed in dry ice in a styrofoam container, lashed to the seat on top of my de-expedition gear. 6 weeks on a South Seas island, staying at an estate with a grateful and most beautiful hostess? Well, surely there would be a little time to operate my little K2. Perhaps not. My faithful Lycoming engine drones on. The massive storm I had encountered had spit me and my little Cessna out at 14,000 feet. I had had no choice but to go through the line of storms. By the time I encountered it, I did not have enough fuel to go anywhere except Tiki Roa. The storm had an enormous updraft. I had entered the storm at 5,000 feet and had exited at 14,000 feet. Now, bruised, battered, but intact, I surveyed my situation. The GPS radios are out thanks to the lightning hits. I must find Tiki Roa. Surely it should be in sight now. And I scan the horizon. I reckon I am at 580 miles west of Papeete, over the trackless waters of the Central Pacific. My compass works, as do my basic instruments, but without my GPS I am lost. If I do not find Tiki Roa soon, the vital serum will be of no value to the people dying on the island. Nor will I be creating massive pileups. Instead, I'll be shark bait, my airplane a reef for the fishes, sharing the ocean with Amelia Earhart. I lean the engine just a hair more, desperate to wring all the distance I can from the remaining fuel. I decide to hold my altitude. I can see farther from on high, and I can glide more than 20 miles from this altitude, even with the dead engine. I hold my compass course, but I fear I could be drifting considerably, not knowing the wind. I scan the horizon with my binoculars, to no avail. I look down. Perhaps wave action could give me some idea of the wind, so I can see if I've been drifting. But to the extent that I can tell from almost 3 miles up, the waves show me what I fear. I now have a headwind. I scan the horizon again. Tiki Roa is a coral reef island with a lagoon and lies low in the water. It is unlikely I'll be able to spot it unless I'm within 30 miles of it. Wait, isn't the haze on the horizon a little brighter? Just to the left of my course? I touch the rudder with my foot and turn my plane to head towards the spot. Probably means nothing, but what other hope is there? Within 5 minutes, there is no doubt that the spot is indeed brighter, and that can be only one thing, lagoon fire, reflected sunlight off the calm water inside a lagoon, reflected in the haze above. The light gets brighter. Bob, did you fall asleep? Surely the band must be dead by now. The light in the stairwell that my wife had just turned on reflects off my world map. And don't forget, tomorrow's garbage day. Put the can out and then come to bed. Yes, dear, you're right, thanks. I look at the clock. Wow, 2 hours since I started tuning. She's right, the band is long dead. I turn off the gear and head up the steps. I know I'll be back on watch tomorrow night. What choice do I have? I'm a DXer. Again, that's the excerpt. The book's called A Year of DX by Bob Locher, W9KNI. Again, published by Idiom Press, copyright 2010. The chapter that I read was chapter 15, Walter Mitty, DXer. I just think it's very, very creative, and I really, really enjoyed I enjoyed the entire book, talking about his attempt at the CQ marathon, the trials that he had to go through in making all the contacts, and interspersed between the month-by-month account of his attempt at during the CQ marathon, he talks about other aspects of amateur radio antennas and QTH setups, but he also threw in that one chapter, kind of a Walter Mitty-esque type story with amateur radio. So I really quite enjoyed that, and I'm glad I had the opportunity to share it with you. Well, that's it for this episode. I'm Scott, AD7MI, and I invite you to join me again on Radio Safari.